Blog Talk Radio.
This is Monica Leal welcoming you to the LL Research radio program In the Now with Carla L. Ruckert. Today is Friday, May 4th, 2012. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic, seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. Please visit LL Research websites, llresearch.org, home to over 1,500 channeling transcripts, 11 publications, The Law of One material, interviews, speeches, and more. And bringforth.org, bring the number 4th.org, featuring forums, blogs, chat rooms, and more. I'll be asking Carla questions that come from you. If you'd like to ask Carla a question live on the air, please call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. Again, that number is 646-595-2294. Or join the chat room at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. When submitting questions, please remember that this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Monica Leal, and I'm talking with Carla L. Ruckert of LL Research. Carla, are you with us?
I am. How are you?
Okay. All right. Had a close call there. We had some internet problems earlier and barely got in on time. So
I wondered about that.
Yeah.
At about 1 minute out, I thought, I don't think I'm on the air unless Monica's on the air. I don't think that I can do this by myself.
Yeah.
I'm really glad to see that you're here.
That was a close one.
And so I'm happy to say that I twisted my husband's arm and he's with me tonight, Jim McCarty.
Hello. Okay. Hello.
Hey, Jim. I'm glad you joined us. It's always
great to be here.
Fantastic. Well, so just want to let you know, in case you lose me for a minute, I'll get right back on.
Okay, well, I'll vamp. I have some wonderful questions from some of the people here that are large enough to keep us talking forever.
Okay,
what
fantastic.
What is nothingness is one of my favorite.
Oh.
Okay.
great. Well,
I want to tell you that we are hived in here in the house, and we've allowed the tourists to take over the city this week because it's Derby week, and the Derby is tomorrow. So naturally, the citizens of Louisville just hive in and barbecue and wear funny hats and have a good time in their backyards and give the city to the tourists, of which there are boatloads and tons. And it's a spectacle for a while. It's always
sounds
fun.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's Kentucky's one moment in the sun lasts 2 minutes.
Uh-huh.
Of course, okay. People that play basketball would object to my saying that. But it is a very premier 2 minutes.
Okay. Fantastic. Well, we do have an opening riff for today from session 32, question 9. Questioner, I am assuming from what we've previously looked at, we have on Earth today and have had in the past fourth, fifth, and sixth density wanderers. As they come into incarnation in the physical of this density for a period as a wanderer, what types of polarizations with respect to these various rays do they find affecting them? Can you tell me that? I am Ra. I believe I grasped the thrust of your query. Please ask further if this answer is not sufficient. Fourth density wanderers, of which there are not many, will tend to choose those entities which seem to be full of love or in need of love. There is the great possibility, probability, of entities making errors in judgment due to the compassion with which other selves are viewed. The fifth density wanderer is one who is not tremendously affected by the stimulus of the various rays of other self, and in its own way offers itself when a need is seen. Such entities are not likely to engage in the, shall we say, custom of your peoples called marriage, and are very likely to feel an aversion to childbearing and child raising due to the awareness of the impropriety of the planetary vibrations relative to the harmonious vibrations of the density of light. The sixth density, whose means of propagation you may liken to what you call fusion, is likely to refrain to a great extent from the bisexual reproductive programming of the bodily complex, and instead seek out those with whom the sexual energy transfer is of the complete fusion nature, insofar as this is possible in manifestation in third density.
Thank you, Monica. I picked this opening riff out because so much of L&L research's discussions have to do with wanderers, our books, our readings through the years. A big concern has been to support the wanderers of the planet. Once we found that that was part of the picture and realized that we were part of that picture, that's where we belonged, and that's where our area of service would be. We've tried to find out more about what wanderers are and find out about, you know, how to support these very brave people who have decided very sacrificially to come to this planet, which is not in the comfort zone at all for anybody that is from another density, and attempt to lighten the consciousness of the planet by living according to that different vibration that is remembered from elsewhere. What wanderers have in common is that they can't imagine ahead of time how difficult something's going to be. Ahead of time, it all sounds like a great romance. We'll go and save planet Earth. And it sounds like derring do and knights and on horses and riding out to save the world. And of course, you know, that's why Don Quixote is our logo. I picked Picasso's drawing of Don Quixote because I identified so much with the way we tilted windmills, riding on our spavined horses and making do with whatever we can. It's a wonder that any of us is able to remember through the veil who we are and what our job is. But so many of us are awakening now. And I thought that it might be good to focus on how you could cope by looking at wanderers and saying, you know, it's not just one blanket term, wanderer, because there are wanderers from different places. So once you identify what density you undoubtedly are from, it's a little bit easier to realize how to work at balancing your distortions, as Ra would say, as far as prejudices against living in third density, so that you can do your job, you know, get on with it and do the job you came to do, penetrate the forgetting process, and develop a magical personality. So let's look at what they said. Fourth density wanderers, they said, will tend to be drawn to people, you know, for mates or for friends or whatever, who are either full of love, just bursting with love, and they're attracted to that energy, or they feel like they found someone they can really help, who really needs their love. That's often very powerful for somebody that wants to love, and you meet somebody that is just so melancholy and blue, and you feel that perhaps you could help them where other people haven't been able to. So you're working on finding a modicum of wisdom in with all that compassion and affection. If if you happen to be a younger person, you may well be a fourth density wanderer. When we were asking this question of those of Ra in 1981, 30 years ago and more, there were not very many fourth density wanderers here. But we have had a ton of people graduate from Earth's third density in the last few years because the vibrations have been ready enough that the steps of light appear. The time of harvest is here. And if you walk the steps of light and you end up in fourth density, why, there you are. You know, you regroup, you talk to your higher self, you get oriented and decide what you want to do for your next incarnation. Well, a lot of people from the earth plane decided that the first service that they wanted to offer in fourth density was to come back to earth as a fourth density wanderer and try to commit some sort of restitution to the planet itself. So if you're a young person, you're most likely a fourth density wanderer, full of love and prone to error only because you need to count to 10 and look for wisdom. Okay, a fifth density wanderer is one who has been overbalanced towards wisdom, obviously. He or she tends to be aloof and to be on the sad side and really to suffer the vibration, so the vibrational difference. And good people, very interested in their own balance, because it is wise to be very interested in becoming more balanced. And the one big reason for incarnating as a fifth density wanderer is to work on the self, more so than the fourth density wanderers or the sixth. So you can kind of look at the Generation X characteristics and the fifth density wanderer characteristics and make some sort of loose suggestion that if you're of the X generation age, you may well be a fifth density wanderer. And what that means is that you are striving to add an open heart to your already profound wisdom. And then for the sixth density wanderer, well, really you have to take potluck on that, because the sixth density is a density of unity. And once you penetrate the veil and remember that you are a wanderer and that you have a job to do here on earth, you might have felt one of several ways as to what you wanted to do for your own soul evolution. You might have wanted to strengthen any of three energies, love, wisdom, or power. So you put yourself in a situation because of various reasons. If you're a sixth density wanderer, and those of us of a certain age almost always are, there are a lot of sixth density wanderers around. What was it, Jim? 65 million, the Ra said, were around in 1981.
That was the total of all the wanderers from all densities, but the Ra did say the great number of them were from the sixth density.
Sixth density, yeah. So there might be, you know, having incarnations that have various incarnational lessons. But the idea is for sixth density is obviously to balance and become completely balanced, able to act in a unified manner, powerfully, lovingly, and wisely. So that is the way you can approach helping yourself out, because it is sometimes lonely and miserable to be a wanderer. And if you can use your undoubtedly considerable brain power to analyze the situation to a certain extent and kind of figure out where you fit in to these generations of wanderers, you can figure more closely how to help yourself. And I think the great thing about this particular material that the Ra gives, dry and dense as it is that it gives you resources for being able to understand where you came from, where you are, you know, like those signs in the malls that say you are here, that give you a great big sign that says you are here in third density, graduating to fourth, and, you know, here's the situation. So I'm just wanting people to use this resource of grasping the nature of the sacrifice that you took on if you're a brother or sister of sorrow and have come here as a wanderer. You should be, you know, just so proud of yourself for making this sacrifice. And now that you're here in boot camp, you know, it's time to do what you came to do. Hard as it is, you know, you pretty much have to gut it out. Jim, how can you add to that?
Well, I think that most entities who feel that they are wanderers do feel a sense of needing to be of service to others and of wondering just exactly what that service is, because it's not usually obvious. It's something that you have to meditate on, you have to think about, you have to really give it some time to soak in and to percolate a little bit. And then kind of take things slowly and go forward with whatever presents itself to you as opportunities to be of service, and follow that little, what you might call a trail of breadcrumbs,
mm-hmm.
and keep gaining information, keep gaining experience, and keep looking for what the universe and your spirit guides present to you as opportunities to be of service. And once you open yourself up in that way, then it seems to become much more easily determined as to what your service is. It just happens to you on a day-by-day basis.
Yes. Monica, anything to add?
I think you guys pretty much covered it.
Okay. Well, thanks for the opportunity to get on my soapbox. I will now get off the soapbox briefly while you ask another question.
Okay. And if anybody would like to call in live, we love having live callers. Please call us at 646-595-2294. That's 646-595-2294. Be sure and press the 1 key if you want to join the show live. You're listening to In the Now with Carla L. Ruckert and Monica Leal and Jim McCarty. Okay, our first question.
Uh-oh. Well, what do?
I guess we wait. It's like something just went click and she was gone. A switch or something thrown somewhere.
Because I'm still pretty sure that I can't be heard unless Monica's on. It does show that Monica's on. Well, you know what?
Did you hear all that?
I didn't hear a bit of it. I was just trying to figure out if... No, you were. It was completely silent. Jim and I were sitting here discussing whether or not I should start talking about something.
Oh, wow. That
so
is
what
strange.
Question did you ask?
Okay,
tell me.
Let me read it again then. You know what? I think my headset may have come loose. I just tightened it. I just noticed
good.
The light went out, so that's probably what it was. Okay, let's do that again. Take two. From God-Wide Void... Is it possible at all for an entity in any particular density to be able to experience and perceive in full a higher density without their consciousness having already evolved or been to that existential nexus? Or is that the only way? For instance, if a third density being were able to fully access the experience of the eighth density, and it was without a shadow of a doubt the eighth density that was being shown, having it stated, you shall be shown the eighth density, what does this entail? Are preemptive glimpses possible, or can only one who holds the memory of being there, having their consciousness evolve to that point, be afforded such an experience?
Well, God-wide, underline. I like the question in that it pulls you into the contemplation of how we know anything. Epistemology, in a nutshell, how do we know what we know? And it's very likely that had we not been there, we would miss what we saw, not being familiar enough with that particular system of illusions to be able to translate. I'm thinking, Jim, of the complications that you look at when you look at how people see. Perception is not at all what it seems. You're looking at something and your brain computer, your biocomputer, is receiving pixels of knowledge, and it's putting together a reproduction of upside down and backwards of what's in front of your corneas. And so it's a bunch of pixels until your mind sort of begins to make sense of the amalgamation and picks out things with which it is familiar. For instance, I think it's 6 or 7 times more likely to look at something in your view if it's a person than if it is not. We think we're looking at the whole view, but in actuality, we're focusing only intermittently and only with a skewed and distorted ability to remember. You really have to be trained to remember more than just the merest detail of what you're looking at. We just don't train ourselves to look very well. The whole question of perception is absolutely fascinating, and thank you for bringing the question up. I think that one thing that illustrates it is, here are two stories that give you the two sides of it, and they both have to do with Don Elkins, our beloved boss and co-researcher who died in 1984. He was a deeply dedicated psychic researcher for many years, from 1955 on. Well, to indicate what you can perceive, one time he was meditating and all of a sudden he was in another reality. Now, I was with him then, so I saw this happen. And he said he was in this reality where the colors were protean and rich and vibrant and alive and moving and flowing for about 40 minutes, that he could open his eyes and see the room around us and then close his eyes and be back in that place. And he loved that place, and he was just crazy about it. It was golden, you know. And so he asked about it, and the Ra group said that they wouldn't advise him to try to get back there because that was just repeating something that he'd already done. And that would suggest that you see the shape of something from memory rather than being able, from a standstill, to grok a situation. On the other hand, sometimes you can see something that is absolutely impossible, and you just have to admit that that's so. And Don was a good example on that, too, because he was sitting meditating with a fellow named Frank. And Frank was quite a character. And they were both pilots, and they used to do a lot of charter work, and they used to do a lot of meditating together. And he and Frank were meditating one night, and Don's arm started going up and down from the elbow to the wrist, sitting there on the arm of the chair, and it just kept moving up and down without his volition at all. He wasn't doing a thing. He was sitting there watching it, as was Frank. Well, it started turning blue. And the message that came through from Spirit was that they were charging his battery. Now, he couldn't have experienced that before, but he saw it, you know, and so did Frank. And Don's memorable reply when he said, "You see that, Frank?" And Frank said, "You're turning blue." times. I'm so glad you see that, Frank. Now, I don't think we can perceive accurately until we have had a chance to absorb and become familiar with the nuances of situations, like, for instance, looking at an eighth density from our standpoint as third density mind-body-spirit complexes.
Okay. Jim, did you have anything to add to that?
No, I would just underline what Carla said. I think that whatever we would perceive of a higher density would be colored by our experience in this density. We have bodies that are constructed to fit into this density and to give us the ability to move about and to take advantage of what this density has to teach us. But these bodies are limited when it comes to perceiving higher densities, and we can only get a glimpse and an indication of what's available in the higher densities, and then we have to interpret it by what we our sensibilities here. So in any way of perceiving, it would be somewhat distorted and would be very personal to us, and it would form kind of a riddle for us that we would have to take some time and effort to solve and to get information from. But we can begin to perceive the higher densities, but only begin here.
Kind of like, you know, I don't think I ever actually saw the book, but I remember hearing about a book called Flatland, and it was about a two-dimensional world. And if you take a ball, and if you were to try to pass the ball through a sheet of paper to the characters in the two-dimensional world, it would just look like a circle. It wouldn't be the ball, because in other words, you just see a circle on a flat plane. That is a three-dimensional ball, but in 2D.
Right.
Well, we're talking about that's dimensions, not densities, but the same idea, mm-hmm. You know. So if we're not really able to perceive the higher densities really accurately, then do you think we can actually know which density we're from? Because being that we were just talking about, you know, the various wanderers from fourth, fifth, or sixth density.
Yeah.
Or do you think that's
I don't think you can ever know anything like that for sure. I think that the whole one way that you know you're on the right track is when you can't prove what you're trying to find out, if it's true or not. If it's a metaphysical, legitimate truth, it cannot be proven. And I think that is strictly a protection of free will, the law of confusion that Ra was so fond of, leaving us completely free to make our choice of serving the light or serving the darkness, serving love or serving fear. It's not just other densities that we have difficulty perceiving. And I think perception is one of the greatest problems in human communication and interaction. It's so easy to misperceive. It's so easy to misunderstand. And it is so difficult to see spaciously so that you don't go from judgment to judgment and keep narrowing the scope of what you can understand. I think that, you know, we spend our lives trying to learn to perceive well, to see what is actual and authentic about ourselves, about other people, about life in general. And many are the ways that we can misperceive and that we can just not get a clue. So it's a lifetime challenge. The question of how do we perceive, what do we perceive, and how can we be sure that what we're perceiving is accurate? I don't know if you can hear me, but Monica, you're off again.
Okay, I'm back.
Oh, good.
I'm really glad. I warned you. Skype's been knocking me off, and I thought we had it fixed, but apparently it's not fixed. So anyway, I was going to ask you a question on that. If people are having what they perceive as past life memories or visions of being on another planet that was very beautiful and harmonious or whatever, and kind of seems like, oh, gosh, that must have been fourth density or it must have been sixth density or whatever, am I hearing you say there's not really any way to really know that? It's kind of just speculation then?
That's right. All of metaphysics is speculation. I think that one of the most important things that the Ra group ever said was that it is unimportant what we know. We begin to become capable of being magical beings when we realize that we don't know anything. Jim, do you remember where that is in the Ra material?
But not specifically, but Ra mentioned that the third density is not the density of understanding.
Yeah.
So it's our intentions that really motivate us and power us here, and our openness of heart and our desire to be of service.
I think that dismays people, and I think when somebody wonders, well, why do fundamentalist religious people act like that? Why do they grab all that dogma and wave it around as if it actually was the real thing, when it's pretty obvious that it's pretty silly? And you know, like the Emperor's New Clothes, everybody doesn't want to say anything about it, but it's pretty silly. So a lot of people feel that way anyway. And I lost my train of thought. Jim, help me out here.
Well, we're talking about that we can't really know for sure anything in particular. All we can do is really intend.
Right. And I think it's the reaction that people have to this great unknown. You know, the concerns of metaphysics have to do with who are we, why are we here, describe our nature, describe our condition, and so forth. And it will automatically bring you into the realm of mystery, because it's all subjective. We can't really know. We can prove something that's in the physical, within the laws of physicality. But the metaphysical world doesn't follow the rules of physicality. It follows the rules of a metaphysical universe, a time-space universe, which are entirely different.
And everything that happens is catalyst of some sort. So if someone is having such visions in my case, I had past life memories when I was a kid, you know, and why was I allowed to remember those? In my case, maybe they were traumatic. But I've heard other people say, well, yeah, but I have memories of being on this beautiful planet. And so do you think those might be clues or some sort of catalyst that they have those memories?
Well, I think that anything that can be imagined or thought is real at some level, because we are thoughts. Remember, in very first session, Ra said we are thoughts dancing together. So if we've thought it, there it is, somewhere in the inner planes. So that makes things more real and less real, because anything that can be imagined is real, but on the other hand, it was imagined. And it ties people up pretty badly to realize that they can't prove that there's a God, that they can't prove his nature or its nature. They can't prove anything about anything. And, you know, the song Stairway to Heaven was just a marvelous statement of the fact that, no, you can't know enough to get to heaven. You can't build a stairway out of wisdom. So, you know, our way to heaven is the way of insight, is the way of intuition, is the way of the feminine energy of love and nurturing and compassion. And there's no knowing, there's no factual side to it. It's totally dependent on your own subjective conclusions based on what you've experienced in life. That's why perception is so important, because depending on how you perceive and what you perceive, you're going to see life in a certain way and cast it in a certain perspective. And you want to cast life in the most accurate and the most broad perspective possible. But so often, we shrink our worlds by limiting what we think is possible. Now, it's always been fascinating to me that and comfortable to me that the world of metaphysics is full of mystery and enigma, because that country feels right to me. I feel better actually in midair than I do on the solid ground, in terms of feeling that I'm in my just right environment. I have a strong drive to adore. And I think that that is part of the human animal. And I don't question it. I just want to be devoted to the Creator. And, you know, I have had my way of developing my relationship with what I see as the Creator. And it's important for everybody simply to put their own time in on drawing up their own universe. Because you are the creator of this mess we call life. And we each have a separate creation, you know, for to some extent we're all prisoners inside our flesh. And we create how we see things. And by how we see and perceive things, we respond to things. And either we respond in fear or we respond in love. So the great trick, the great challenge for us is to, one way or another, and there are infinite ways, become able to be conscious enough to perceive life as it is happening in terms of its possibilities for service.
Now, you're talking about service, love, compassion. I've seen this topic discussed quite a bit on the Bring Forth Forum, and the question comes up, yeah, but what if you're a 5D wanderer and you're supposed to be working on wisdom? Or what if you're from 6D and you're supposed to be balancing, and maybe you shouldn't be focusing on love so much, you need more wisdom, and that sort of thing. There's a lot of questions, because if we are here in 3D, and here in 3D we're supposed to be making a choice, the question then comes up, yeah, but what if haven't we already chosen that if we're wanderers? In other words, should we still be focusing on love and compassion? Is that still the goal, regardless of what density we're from?
Well, sure. If you're going to graduate third density, you have to graduate from the density of choice, and you have to express your polarity and by the nature of how you live in third density. That by definition, you know, it doesn't matter where you come from. You're an earthling now, and you're going to have to pass the same test any earthling does. You have to walk the steps of light. If you've forgotten who you are and gotten real mean, then you lose polarity, and maybe you'll have to stay in third density a while and gain it back. You know, it's really a matter of the spontaneous act of the moment as far as, you know, when we pass on and it's time for us to walk the steps, you know, where is our head? I've admired Gandhi so much, and of course there are many reasons for that, but one great sign of his awareness, the quality of his awareness, was that when he saw he was going to be shot, he made the sign that is Hindu for God, and he said Akram, which is Hindu for God. So he died with the name of God on his lips, and making the sign on his hands, indicating that his mind was entirely on the Creator. I mean, isn't that wonderful to be able to be that conscious that in the moment of death, you simply turn to the Creator?
Wow. I didn't know that. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. You might check out the movie that was made by Richard Attenborough quite some time ago now.
Oh, 1980? Or 82? Probably. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I saw
it
that
was,
in the theater.
Yeah, well, you probably saw them dramatize that at the very end of the movie. Yeah.
I didn't remember that little piece, but, yeah, cool. Yeah, and he was quite, I mean, look at how many people he affected. I mean.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, I think anybody that wants to seek to work in the arena of society, in activism and political consciousness, needs to read Gandhi badly. absorb all that he has to say. He was a wise old coot.
Yeah, a good example of activism from a wanderer standpoint. So, we had a live caller just for a minute, and it looks like they just hung up. So if you were on hold and you'd like to call back, we sure would love for you to call back. We still have time to take your question. In the meantime, let me give that number again. That is 646-595-2294. That's 646-595-2294, and hit the 1 key if you want to join the show. And in the meantime, I'm going to go ahead and go to the next question, which is from Diana. And this is addressed to Carla and Monica and Jim. Thank you for your continued efforts to be of service to those seeking understanding of the Law of One. There seems to me a fine line between being of service to others and interfering with free will. It is my understanding that Ra came through as an answer to a call, thereby not interfering, and being of service. My question involves human service to others. What if, say for example, we're considering small children? Small children cannot defend themselves or speak of their suffering for the most part. Often they cannot be heard directly, although there are times when it is possible to find out directly of child abuse. However, as an individual with compassion, one might feel the pain of suffering children and know of it indirectly. A compassionate person may hear the call of suffering children. So what does one do about it within the directive of not interfering with free will? There is the free will of the abusive parents to consider. There's the free will of child pornographers to consider. There's the free will of the government officials who keep their poor hungry to consider. There's even the free will of the suffering children to consider who may have chosen to suffer, although I have no idea how one would find that out. A compassionate person may heed the call from suffering children in his or her heart. And yet, what to do? If interfering with free will is a prime directive of 3D, how then does one respond compassionately to the suffering of children? Let it be, trusting it will all just work out? Historically, this is not the way things change. And do we not also have an imperative to evolve? This is a matter that continually challenges me. I would like to hear your thoughts.
Well, before I give my thoughts, I'd sort of like to invite a person that's raised a child and a person that has taught small children to offer their suggestions, because they both have had more experience than I at working with small children. And I'll be glad to give my opinions after you guys talk. How's that? Because I really want to hear what you have to say. I think it's a very big question. How do you raise a child and safeguard that child's free will in some way, because obviously there's a challenge there. You can't let the child kill itself, you know. So what do you think, Jim? What do you think, Monica?
Make okay. First. You want me to go first? Or you want to go first, Jim?
Monica, why don't you go first?
Okay.
Since you actually raised a child, and my experience with children was about 40 years ago.
Oh, okay. Well, this is all spontaneous because I didn't know you were going to ask me this. So, okay. Well, my view on that is if the person is within my sphere of influence, if it's my child, that soul incarnated to, you know, in my household, then I feel that I automatically have a responsibility to that child to give that child the absolute best guidance that I can, and take care of their needs in any way that I can, and that includes, you know, love and discipline and everything else that goes with it. And I wouldn't, I would not consider it an infringement on free will to offer that guidance to the child that was entrusted to me by the universe. And when the child gets older, then it does become challenging as the child, you know. In fact, I have a child who was very strong-willed, very, very intelligent, very precocious, very gifted, and there was a lot of challenge to not infringe on his free will. So we did the style of parenting where there was no spanking, there was, you know, I always explained things to him. And when he asked, you know, if he could do something, if I had to say no, I would give it a reason why. And that was because when I was a child, I remember my parents would say, no, because I said so, you know. And I vowed that I would never do that to my child. I would always give a reason. So that was the style of parenting that we chose. And I'm wondering, though, I think in Diana's question, there may be another aspect, and that may be with children that are not directly in our care, maybe children that we're observing, say, for example, the next door neighbor is abusing his child. And that is a lot more difficult question to answer, because how do we help the child without interfering in the free will of the abuser? And I guess and I'm interested in your answer to that, but my guess would be that if it's within our capacity to help, then our first responsibility is to the child, I would think, rather than, because if we're serving STO, if we're STO oriented, wouldn't our first responsibility be to do what we can to answer the call rather than to assist in the STO action? I mean, if it's clearly an STO action. So,
I think, yes.
Yeah, so I think that's kind of what Diana was getting at. You know, how do we, in the case where we may be, you know, the person next door may think we're interfering. Hey, it's my kid. Or even if it's his dog, you know, what if he's beating his dog, you know? I mean, you see the guy out there with a baseball bat beating the dog. I mean, I actually had that happen. My next door neighbor was beating his dog. And I did call the authorities, because how could I not? I mean, you know, so I think that's the question really is, you know, and in his attitude was, hey, it's my dog. I can beat it if I want to beat it. So how do we balance that without interfering with his free will?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that one.
Jim, you taught in lower grades in Florida. What did you feel about free will in small children after a year of that?
Well, I think the younger the child, the more you have to speak for them and help them with their choices, because they're not yet wise enough or experienced enough to make the choices for themselves. The younger the child, the more you do for them. The babe in arms needs almost everything to be done for it. So the older the child gets, the more you're able to help the child express itself as an individualized being. And this is something that it takes, I guess, your own experience and your own following of your intuition to know just when it's appropriate to help the child express itself rather than to make choices for the child. But well, the example you gave of the dog, I mean, that's something that you have to sometimes step in and speak for an entity that cannot speak for itself. And you have to risk infringing upon another entity's free will when you see that what they're doing is destructive. It's something you just have to go with your own intuition and follow it and be the champion of that child or that animal, that entity. It's not always easy. I don't think third density was designed to be easy for us. It was designed to help us to make choices that may be difficult and to grow from those choices. And maybe we won't always make the right choice, but if we're willing to learn from whatever it is we do, then we can always improve our ability to choose and our ability to serve.
Yeah.
That same neighbor that was beating his dog with a baseball bat also had a child. And I never witnessed this, but my other neighbor told me that she had witnessed him abusing the child sexually. And that was pretty creepy. And I really encouraged her to report it, but she didn't. And I think I even tried calling, but they wouldn't witness it.
Right.
So I couldn't really do anything. And that was
I think that really points up the great human lack that we have, and that is in being unable as individuals to be fully responsible for our own government. I think that, you know, in great compassion and sincerity, we set up a court-administered system for children who needed help. And there was always that potential, if the child was being abused, of reporting the situation to the authorities, and the child would become a ward of the court, and they would be brought up in foster homes. And the problem is there was so much abuse in foster homes that it's almost commonplace. And if you talk to enough people that have come up through that system, you begin to wonder if anybody ever got a fair shake from the federal court system coming up, because the system is just so open to corruption, especially corruption on the venal tastes of the people around the small children. There's no guarantee that you're not just jumping from the frying pan into the fire when you go into the court system. So you don't know if the things that you're going to try to do to get the child out of that situation will succeed in giving him a better situation. I think it's a very difficult thing to know exactly what to do when you do see abuse. Of course you want to report it. Do you want to break the family up? You know, it's a difficult situation indeed. And I think the law of one would suggest, as Jim said, you know, waiting for that intuition, that sense of what is the right thing to do, to let you know how to approach it. I certainly don't know any easy answers, Monica.
You know, and even then with the with the neighbor that was abusing his child, I mean, that was a real obvious abuse, and that was a pretty heinous thing, you know, his own daughter. But I think it's even, and like you said, that's really challenging because you don't know if they're going out of the frying pan into the fire. But I know something I've encountered with family members and their children. Sometimes it's not so obvious that it's abuse. It's not something real cut and dry. It's just kind of like emotional abuse, or maybe you suspect it's abuse. And then it really gets difficult, because how do you then, you know, it's not serious enough to where you could call CPS and they would take the children away, and you really wouldn't want that to happen, but you know that child is being emotionally abused, or maybe they're really being spanked excessively, or, you know, something like that. And how do you talk to the parents and suggest that they tone it down without offending them? Because a lot of times they get very defensive and they say, I'm not abusing my kid, and it's none of your business. You know, I disciplined her. She needed it. And sometimes that can cause discord in the family because they think you're being nosy. So how do you champion that child? Because since you are witnessing it, then apparently you are involved already, since you witnessed it, is the way I see it. How do you champion the child without offending the parent, you know? Because on the one hand, I'm thinking, well, maybe the parent on some level wants me to speak up. Maybe she really doesn't realize that she's being abusive to this kid. And if I don't speak up, you know, someday on a soul level, she's going to say, hey, why didn't you speak up, you know?
Right, right.
But on the other hand, if I do speak up, she might get mad at me. She might get, you know, it might cause, some discord between us at the moment. So I guess my question is, what's more important at that moment, championing the child or keeping the peace between me and my sister or my friend or whoever it is?
Hmm. Yeah, and that's probably not really the end of the considerations when you're looking at abuse, because there's so much more involved when you've got a child that has got a future that may be compromised by the way he's had to live. Oh, difficult.
Yeah. And the parent might not even think it's abuse.
It's very sad. You know that it happens a lot more than people think. My mother was a clinical psychologist, and she would talk about statistics and difficulties that people had sometimes. And she said it was absolutely amazing how many unreported occasions of violence, spousal violence and violence to small children, go unreported because of the fact that the people that are being beaten do not want anybody to know what's going on in their house. Simple as that. They just want everybody to mind their business, and, you know, maybe it'll all go away. And I think it's part of a feeling of victimhood, that you feel helpless and hopeless. It's just Earth is a tough place to be. I don't think that there is a child that has come up, with the possible exception of my beautiful husband, Jim McCarty, who had an ideal childhood and can't remember being unhappy a day in his childhood.
Wow.
Most of us have suffered in childhood by things that we felt demeaned us, invaded our privacy, debased our value. For me, it was the opposite of what you experienced. I suffered from over-explanation. My parents wouldn't spank me. God, no. They wouldn't take 5 minutes and just express themselves with their hands. They would take a half hour to convince me that what I had done was wrong and why.
Oh, no, I did that, Carla.
Constitutionally, I obviously thought what I had done was right. I would patiently listen and listen and listen, and then I would say, but I was still right. And he would just be so mad, and he'd have to talk some more. And it was such punishment, and I never could do something where either my mother or father would say, that was perfect, you did great. There was always, well, it wasn't bad. It could have been better, you know.
Oh, no.
You'd have done this, you'd have done that. I always thought that I was pretty much of a lame duck, that I couldn't really do anything right until I got up in years and discovered, hey, what kind of a thing were they giving me there? Why did I listen to them? I was doing really well, you know, but they were just used to me, and they were used to me doing good things, and if I didn't, you know, do everything exactly perfectly, you know, then they didn't talk about doing a good thing. They talked about the mistakes I'd made or if they felt that I'd made. So I grew up feeling very unworthy because of that, and that was a form of emotional abuse. Others probably have much more horrendous stories of how, you know, your childhood was screwed up. But I think we all have difficulties. Most of us have difficulties somewhere in the childhood that have really diminished us if we let them, if we allow them to stay that way. We need, most of us, to get rid of the voices of our childhood because we have felt abuse from various sources of various kinds at various levels. And we need to shake that off and get our balance and realize that it's not important what's been done to us. It's important what we do to people.
I so totally was guilty of that. I mean, we didn't tell our son that he never, I mean, we did. There were lots of times where he did do things what we thought was perfect. So he did get a lot of praise too, but we were definitely guilty of over-explanation. So, oh no, I feel so awful. But no, I can relate. Oh gosh. Well, we do the best we can, don't we? We are out of time. We got like 1 minute. Any quick last comments?
Quick last comments. Nick, you got any? Anything we want to let people know about?
No, it's just such a pleasure to talk to people, and we hope they'll keep sending in their questions and giving us more to talk about.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. Send in the questions, please. I just get such a kick out of being able to enter the conversations that you all have during this hour each week, and I feel so much upliftment when you all write in and you're asking me to share considerations with you. Please know that we don't think we know anything. We're just discussing questions of interest to serious seekers because it really is fun to consider these things and toss them around. And that's part of what we do here at L&L is just find a place where people can chew the fat and hopefully chew it to some help to themselves. Thank you, Monica, for having us. It's been fun.
Thank you, Carla. Thank you, Jim. You have been listening to LL Research's In the Now with Carla L. Ruckert and Jim McCarty. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit llresearch.org and bringforth.org, bring4th.org, which is the LL Research community website. And llresearch.org has the channeling transcripts, the Law of One material. Check it out. Thanks so much for listening. If you'd like to post a question, go to bringforth.org and go to the Q&A section. Have a wonderful week. We will be here next Friday at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern.